Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Coming up, Wyoming lawmakers are pushing back against the public health orders issued in the last year.
It has been out of control. It's inconsistent with our constitutional republic.
The Wyoming legislature is also considering a voter identification bill.
I think it's one more thing that you have to do that you never had to do before in Wyoming.
And a taxpayer-funded study gives a grim forecast of the economic impacts of Biden's climate plans relating to oil and gas. A new investigation between Wyoming Public Radio and The Guardian uncover an important detail.
It's not surprising, and it almost seems normal that a state-funded report would have such influence from industry. But it's really not normal.
Join us for those stories and more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. A new investigation between Wyoming Public Radio and The Guardian uncovers how a frequently cited report truly came about. The taxpayer-funded study considers the economic impacts of the Biden administration's climate plans relating to oil and gas. It gives a grim forecast for Western states. What was not disclosed? The influence and financial support from the oil and gas industry. The study is now making the rounds without that proper detail, from articles in the New York Times to federal hearings. Energy reporter Cooper McKim worked on the story alongside Emily Holden, the founder of Floodlight, a collaborative environmental news site partnered with The Guardian.
So essentially, we found that a study that was being cited widely by Republicans and also making it into a lot of news stories across the West and even nationally was basically had a high level of industry involvement throughout its development. And what it found was that the Biden administration's climate policies, particularly stopping drilling on public lands, would have just economically ruinous effects on Western states. But when the study's been cited, that involvement from industry has not been disclosed.
And it's come up, I think, importantly in instances, in decision-making instances, like with the potential confirmation, we're recording this on Thursday, of Biden's pick for the Secretary of the Interior.
Right. So we published our story Tuesday morning, and just a couple hours later, we saw that Senator Lummis had issued a hold on Biden's nomination to run the Interior Department, Deb Haaland, essentially saying that we're going to try to block this from moving forward in the Senate however possible. And that's something that Democrats can overcome, but it just takes a bit longer. And so they're now not having a vote on her until next week.
So a lawmaker in Montana, Steve Daines, also cited the report, and Lummis did too, correct?
Yes.
Right, and as did our representative here, Liz Cheney. So why do you feel this story in particular was important and important to work on with a local journalist?
This is something that we see happening frequently. And I think that, you know, if you're in a state where industry is really important to the economy, it almost gets to the point where, you know, it's not surprising and it almost seems normal that a state-funded report would have such influence from industry. But it's really not normal. And it's especially untransparent to not disclose that so that people don't understand where the information that they're relying on for their policymakers to make decisions is coming from. So I think this is really the sort of strategy that you've seen from industry over and over again. I think it's something you're seeing increasingly, especially as the oil and gas industry is facing, you know, more climate regulations and efforts from the Biden administration. I think that they are really going to be trying to control the conversation and make it look like there's no way to limit the greenhouse gas emissions causing climate change without massive layoffs and economic ruin and just the collapse of Western state economies that rely on revenues from this industry.
Well, that's all from me. Anything else you wanted to mention before we sign off?
Yeah, I would just emphasize that this study has been making the rounds kind of all over the country. It's reached people from their daily newspapers, which are the sources that they're likely to trust. And the reporters who were referencing it didn't necessarily know about its background. They didn't know that it was the Western Energy Alliance that came up with the idea for the study or offered comments on it throughout or, you know, helped publicize it and then, you know, built a whole ad campaign around it. And I think that's really a problem if even reporters who we depend on to have the best reliable information for us cannot figure something like that out without the kind of investigative deep dive that we're doing. That's really not fair for the public.
Well, thanks, Emily, for joining me.
Thank you.
You can read the full investigation online at wyomingpublicmedia.org. After the 2020 elections and former President Trump's unfounded concerns about voter fraud and election security, several states are looking to improve election security themselves. Wyoming's legislature is considering a voter ID bill for in-person voting. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler has more.
After the 2020 election, legislatures across the country are considering new voting laws. And while no widespread voter fraud has been proven, it has not stopped conservative lawmakers from looking for solutions and new preventive measures. And Wyoming is no different.
House Bill 75, sponsored by Representative Gray, Voter Fraud Prevention.
Wyoming's legislature is considering a bill that would require a voter to show an ID before voting in person. A person would have to provide a driver's license, state or tribal ID card, a passport, military ID, a state public school or college ID, or a Medicare card. And while the original name of the bill was directed at fraud, voter fraud has not been a big issue in Wyoming. Here's Secretary of State Ed Buchanan.
Probably over a couple of decades, we've really had a handful only of documented cases of voter fraud that have resulted in criminal conviction. And that's since the year 2000. And so I would say voter fraud is rare in Wyoming.
He says the bill is a preventive measure and it can be useful to provide more security, especially when it comes to voting in local elections where only a handful of votes can decide a race. And after debate in the House, the bill's title has been amended to just voter identification. But this bill would be a change from how Wyoming currently votes. Crook County Clerk Linda Fritz says right now it's just a verbal confirmation.
The process right now as it stands is that the voter has to identify themselves and give their name, their physical address, oftentimes their mailing address, and in the case of a primary election, they need to give their party so that we make sure they get the right party ballot.
The bill has also been amended to include a fee waiver for getting a state ID card for the purposes of voting. And the addition of the Medicare card will provide an option for older Wyomingites who may not have an ID anymore. Fritz adds, the kind of voter fraud that appears most often in the state is when a felon registers to vote on Election Day and votes, but they have not had their voting rights restored yet. But she says this bill doesn't address that issue. There have been concerns about what barriers this bill could potentially create. Jackson Representative Mike Yin says when a voter doesn't bring their ID to the polls on Election Day, they won't be turned away, but they'll only be allowed to fill out a ballot that can't be counted until they've proven their identity.
I think it's one more thing that you have to do that you never had to do before in Wyoming. And so that the barrier is essentially for people who may not have any ID on them but are registered to vote already. They either have to fill out a provisional ballot or come back. And you know, I think statistically, if enough people are turned away, some percent of them will not come back.
But the bill has wide support across both the House and the Senate, with close to 60 lawmakers sponsoring the bill. Many supporters, including its sponsor, Casper Representative Chuck Gray, says this will address Wyomingites' concerns with election security.
This is about ensuring our place, our state's place, as the gold standard of the country, and making sure our state believes in our elections, which is essential.
Secretary of State Buchanan says he thinks the reassurance might be able to improve voter participation.
For the most part, people see our elections in a positive light. But if you can let them know that you're being proactive in preventing fraud and making sure your processes are tight, then they know that their vote counts. And I think that can go a long way towards hopefully reducing a lot of the voter apathy that you see.
But Representative Yin says this shouldn't be the way voters gain more confidence in the voting process.
I think what solves that problem is election officials helping educate people on the process that happens, and then leaders showing leadership, which is essentially telling the public what they already know, which are our elections are secure, right? So people gain confidence when their leaders are also confident.
The bill will soon be considered in the Wyoming Senate. But at the same time, the U.S. House of Representatives recently passed a bill that would allow for a workaround for voters in states with voter identification laws by providing a written statement. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler.
Coming up, Deb Haaland's nomination to lead the Department of Interior has faced loud opposition from senators with ties to oil and gas. But some tribes who rely on those industries see it differently. It's all coming up next on Open Spaces.
This time on The Modern West, we find out whether my parents move away from their small town, shrinking it even more.
I don't have a big interest in moving there. You know, personally, to have things to do, to get up in the morning and go, okay, I'm going to fill in the blank. Well, it is a blank.
It's the final chapter of our Ghost Towning series. Find The Modern West under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org, sponsored by Sheridan Travel and Tourism.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Deb Haaland's road to become Secretary of the Interior has been rocky. This week, Republican Senators Steve Daines of Montana and Cynthia Lummis of Wyoming placed a hold on her nomination, citing concerns about her positions on fossil fuel industries. Still, as the Mountain West News Bureau Savannah Maher reports, some tribal communities in our region that depend on fossil fuels are looking to Haaland to help them diversify.
Deb Haaland's confirmation hearings were full of tense exchanges, many of them with Republican Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming.
If I'm confirmed, I would seek partnerships with states, with tribes, with local communities to talk about this important issue. And
I'm talking about the law.
On day two, he brought something unexpected to the table.
I have a letter from the Northern Arapaho Business Council in Wyoming, and they are opposing the president's ban on leasing.
It felt like a gotcha moment, as in Haaland claims to have support from tribes. And yet,
the Northern Arapaho Business Council letter states, delays in leasing have already negatively impacted
It was disheartening and disappointing.
That's the chairman of the Northern Arapaho Business Council, Jordan Dresser. He says Barrasso left out two key facts. First, that the letter was addressed to the acting Interior Secretary, not the Senate committee. And second, the Business Council had written directly to Barrasso, asking him to support Haaland.
She has the power to be a voice for us. And I felt like the context was that we didn't support her, when in actuality, we do.
Like the state of Wyoming, the Northern Arapaho tribe is heavily reliant on the fossil fuel industry.
Oil and gas is bread and butter for our tribe and a lot of other tribes.
Those tribes use fossil fuel revenues to pay for government operations and social services. That revenue is especially important because, unlike states, tribes don't have a tax base to fall back on if those industries go south. So Dresser says it's past time to diversify.
We're doing ourselves a disservice by relying on something that's not renewable.
And the tribe could be well positioned to succeed in the wind and solar industries. That's according to Eric Henson with Harvard's Project on American Indian Economic Development.
You know one thing that tribes have massive access to? Wind and sun.
The problem, he says, is that many reservations are hundreds of miles from big population centers.
You know how incredibly expensive it is to build high voltage transmission lines from, say, the Great Plains to Seattle or Minneapolis? Really expensive. Who the heck's got the money to take that on? The federal government.
And the feds do have a trust responsibility to ensure tribes have the resources to care for their people. That's what was offered in exchange for the millions of acres of indigenous land that now make up the United States. And yet, many reservations lack the basic building blocks of a modern economy.
Got kids who don't have running water. American citizens who happen to be American Indians also, they don't have running water.
Never mind those high-voltage transmission lines, he says. And according to Maxine Velasquez, tribal infrastructure has been a particularly low priority in the last 4 years.
We haven't had much of a relationship with the Department of Interior, not much of a reach out at all from the last administration.
Velasquez heads up the economic development arm of the Laguna Pueblo, and she wants the corporation to diversify beyond the casinos and hotels it currently operates, maybe into wind and solar.
And this is why it's important to put that infrastructure in the ground and have that water and electric and broadband and everything we need to be able to build these renewable energy investments.
Velasquez says that as a former tribal administrator, Deb Holland knows what tribes are up against.
She'll understand where those tribal leaders are coming from.
And that could be why many tribal leaders with ties to oil and gas are supportive of Holland's confirmation. Plus, Chairman Jordan Dresser says those tribal leaders know a thing or two about adapting to new circumstances, perhaps more so than their counterparts in Congress.
As Native people, we've always been very fluid with things, and we have always recognized that things have the power to change.
As Interior Secretary, Holland has signaled she will include tribes in the Biden administration's sustainable infrastructure plans. Tribal leaders are ready to hold her to it. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Savannah Marr.
Zach Kenna went to art school at the University of Wyoming, then moved to California to become an independent filmmaker. Over the past couple of years, Kenna has written and illustrated a comic inspired by his father's stories growing up on the Wind River Indian Reservation. Wyoming Public Radio's Taylor Stagner has more.
Zach Kenna is from Green River, Wyoming. Growing up, he had always loved horror stories. And after 2.5 years of work, Kenna has finally published a graphic novel called Crowheart Butte, a story set on the Wind River Indian Reservation about St. Stephen's basketball team trying to survive creatures in the shadow of the famous butte. I asked Kenna what he likes about scary stories.
You can tell a very dramatic story through comic books, which a lot of people think superheroes, they think those sort of things. But comics are limitless, you know. Yeah, when I sat down to do the graphic novel, I was looking to do a horror because I've always been a big fan of horror comics as well as film. And I thought it'd be, you know, ultimately, first of all, very fun to draw, very fun to illustrate.
Kenna is a Shoshone descendant, but doesn't identify as Native American. But he cares deeply about the Wind River Indian Reservation and wanted to depict characters there in a meaningful way.
And I wasn't necessarily trying to make a statement piece when I decided I wanted to focus on Native Americans for sort of the central characters of this book. But I knew that that would kind of come up because if you're going to honestly depict characters in that setting, going through those different types of experiences, then you're going to have to be honest with some of the issues. So, you know, I really wanted to do a horror creature feature like through comics, but and also, you just don't see Native Americans in a lot of media in general. I mean, it's not just horror, but in pop culture, this is just not something that is depicted often in mainstream type of media. I mean, there's exceptions, but overall, yeah, it's just something you don't see often, and I definitely want that to change. So yeah, I decided that would be a really interesting sort of story.
Kenna remembers going to visit Fort Washakie as a kid, and the stories he would hear about the reservation inspired him to write Crowheart Butte.
That's where my dad grew up. And so because I have that connection, I wanted to explore that further, you know. And my dad grew up in Fort Washakie. He told me lots of stories about growing up there, his experiences. And, you know, when he would tell me different experiences, it wasn't like I was thinking of them as being Native experiences or, you know, specific to a certain demographic or anything. It was just interesting childhood stories.
I asked Kenna if it's appropriate for children to read. His answer was probably not.
But yeah, it's not really intended for kids. I would have read something like this when I was younger for sure, but I wouldn't recommend it for kids because, I mean, it does have, you know, language, violence.
He is inspired by Shoshone Chief Washakie, and in fact, the book begins with a quote from the famous chief.
I was always fascinated by Chief Washakie just because I knew that, you know, being Shoshone in that area, that was where my dad grew up. That was, you know, those were the natives that I was always so fascinated by, the Shoshone. Where, like, you know, most people just are focused on the Lakota, because that's, you know, all the famous battles and stuff like that. But yeah, Washakie and the Eastern Shoshone was always what I was really interested in. And it's, in terms of folklore, it's based on the Numerigar, which are, you know, in Shoshone folklore, they're like a little race of evil people, I guess. But I didn't want to just make them so transparent like that. I wanted to make them more complex. So they're a little different than the actual Shoshone legends. But when I, like I said, when I first sat down to do the novel, it was, I wanted to do a creature monster type of story. And, but I also wanted to be honest to like actual Shoshone legends. And, you know, there was, honestly, I didn't see a lot of, I haven't heard a lot of Shoshone legends that are about like creature monsters. It was really the Numerigar were the, probably one of the more prominent ones that I've come across. And they're not, like I said, they're not monsters. They're beings. They're very human beings. And in order to portray even them, which are, I guess they're the villains of the book, they had to be rounded themselves. And you kind of had to understand where they were coming from. Even if what they ultimately choose to do is wrong, you had to understand why and how they got to that point.
You can buy Crowheart Butte at zekkennaart.com. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Taylor Stagner.
When we come back, many lawmakers are trying to insert themselves into future public health orders. This is Open Spaces.
This time on Human Nature, Wynn thought he had to pass for straight, even in his beloved outdoors. But then a special pair of boots came into his life.
Photos are getting taken and things got posted to the internet. And then I came home to my house being egged.
These boots were made for hiking. I'm Erin Jones. Find Human Nature under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Dissatisfaction with how Wyoming handled the pandemic has reached the legislature. Bills and budget amendments have been crafted to remove the power of the state health officer and to put legislators and county commissioners into the driver's seats. Gillette Senator Troy McEwen got the ball rolling with his legislation that originally limited the governor's ability to extend statewide health orders beyond 30 days without legislative approval. It would also limit a local health order to 15 days without local government approval. He says the health orders, especially those that closed or limited business operations, were especially harmful.
I think it all started out with frustration in small businesses and some of the decisions that were made statewide that may or may not have made sense.
McEwen's bill now allows a statewide order to run for 60 days before legislative involvement and 30 days before local officials get involved. It also requires 48 hours of public testimony before an order goes into effect.
I don't want to pick on anybody or say somebody did something wrong, because they did what the statute says. I think we wandered away from the state constitution, and that really kind of bothered me.
McEwen is among those in the legislature who doubts that the health orders had much of an impact and says people should not live in a bubble. Fellow Gillette Senator Jeff Wasserberger says whether things went right or wrong depends on your perspective.
If you listen to the medical profession, it was a lucky thing in the state of Wyoming that we didn't have a higher death count than what we ended up with. And the restrictions saved lives. But the small businessmen lost all kinds of money, restaurants, a difficult time, hotels, and they're still angry about it. And I can understand why.
The target of their ire is State Health Officer Dr. Alexia Harris. Roughly a year ago, few people had ever heard of Harris, and then suddenly she became one of the most famous people in the state. High school tournaments and activities were canceled. Businesses were closed, and Wyoming residents started working from home. She told a legislative committee this week that they needed to take a strong approach when the pandemic broke out because they didn't know what they were dealing with.
Didn't have the testing capability that we needed. Severe actions were needed at that point to protect the public health. But I do think our response has examples of how we learned more about activities that were important, but take reasonable, balanced measures to protect the public health at the same time.
That would include the statewide mask order implemented in December when hospitals were near capacity.
It has been out of control. It's inconsistent with our constitutional republic.
That's Casper State Representative Chuck Gray, who thinks many things are unconstitutional. He is a familiar voice for the Republican right, and he has targeted Harris by trying to eliminate funding for her position in the state budget and require that her position get Senate confirmation. Gray says Harris and local health officials caused tremendous economic damage to the state.
Overnight, the most powerful person in our state became an unelected official issuing these mandates. It is just totally wrong. It is inconsistent with our constitutional republic. That's what we've been trying to correct here.
How incredibly insulting to an individual who has been doing her job. I mean, that was just an insult.
That's House Minority Leader Kathy Connolly. The Laramie Democrat has not been surprised by the Republican response, but she has found it alarming.
We need to trust the experts, the people that we have put in charge who are knowledgeable about those issues, and those bills reverse that. But instead, inserting politics into it, it's a wrong choice all the way around.
Gillette Senator Jeff Wasserberger likes a bill that would require a review of the pandemic response and study what went right and wrong. But he thinks that should be conducted when emotions aren't quite as strong.
Actually, every month that we get further away from the pandemic, the better things are going to be. And then we can look back with a clear head and make better decisions for the future and the next pandemic.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck. A global pandemic has a way of bringing our mortality into focus. How do we want things to go at the end? There is an emerging profession that may help you and your family answer that question. The Mountain West News Bureau's Madeline Beck reports.
It was 2018. Chris Bruton was 47, and his dad was dying.
And he actually had stage 4 kidney cancer. He was basically given about 2 to 4 months to live.
When Bruton was a kid, his dad traveled a lot, so we didn't get to know him that well. But after Bruton's mom died, his dad moved in with him in Colorado. A year later, that diagnosis came. Someone Bruton knew suggested a death doula.
And of course, I'd never heard of it. It sounded a little bit hocus-pocus-y to me.
And then he met Cindy Kaufman and introduced her to his dad.
And as I walked out, I heard sobbing from my father that I had never heard before. And it just this well of stress and fear, anxiety, sadness, it all just came out.
Kaufman came by one or two times a week and drove down for the end. Even though he'd never heard of a death doula before, Bruton is now a convert.
I had no idea how much work there was to do to help someone who's going through the dying process until I saw what Cindy did. And yeah, changed our lives. Changed our lives and changed my dad's life at the very end of it.
Death doulas are also called death midwives or end-of-life doulas, but whatever you call them, their numbers have blossomed in the last decade. There's a few in every state, but Colorado is a hot spot in the Mountain West. Cindy Kaufman leads the Colorado End-of-Life Collaborative.
End-of-life doulas fill what we believe is a gap.
That gap is the space between hospices, which provide necessary medical care, and what she does, help someone with the actual process of dying. She adds that since it started in the 70s and 80s, the hospice industry has become more of a business these days, with certain hours and staff caring for multiple clients. In fact, the majority of hospices are now for-profit institutions.
We don't carry those kind of caseloads. We work for ourselves. We don't fall under insurance. We're private pay.
She says death doulas can bring ritual back into dying and make it easier to say goodbye. They can help plan legacy projects, say late night prayers, figure out what kind of burial or cremation you want. For some, they just sit with people right up to the end. And death doulas are incredibly diverse, not only in what they offer, but with their backgrounds. There's no licensing requirement or mandatory training. Kaufman says some people who use their own culture to inform how they practice as death doulas want it to stay that way.
They want to be honored for the fact that they were trained within their own family and community to do what they do.
Still, several international training centers have cropped up in recent years, some in places like Australia and the UK, and one in New Jersey, the International End-of-Life Doula Association. Henry Fersko Weiss is a death doula who created that organization 6 years ago.
Anybody could call themselves a doula without knowing anything. Without having any training.
He says it's good to take other cultures into consideration, but the profession needs standardization if they want to be reimbursed by Medicare or Medicaid. He says this change could also improve quality of care. Plus, he says it needs to happen for this fledgling profession to evolve and gain trust. Deb Rawlings teaches palliative care at Flinders University in Australia. She's one of the few people who've done any research on this occupation.
It was amazing to find there were so many differences in what the death doulas say that they do and in what they offer.
She found that many death doulas are former hospice workers or nurses. Some volunteer, others charge, some help with a spiritual journey, others help with more physical tasks. But even though they're so different, they all told her,
"We've got time. So I've got time to come in and sit with you. I might sit with the person who's dying and let their family go and have a break. I might help and do the washing."
So they've got time to be with those who are running out of it. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Madeline Beck.
The pandemic's economic toll has left many in the Mountain West struggling to feed their families. In fact, two states in our region are at the top of a list that some don't want to be on, with some of the nation's highest rates of child food insecurity. Nevada is tied with Louisiana at number one. New Mexico ranks third. Stephanie Serrano of the Mountain West News Bureau has more.
Emily Engelhard is the director of research at the nonprofit Feeding America. It published the data on food insecurity in the fall. She says the story has two parts.
One is that we're seeing the areas that historically have had the highest levels of food insecurity continue to have the highest levels of food insecurity.
Especially, she says, people of color. And the second part of that story is the tourism and service industries have been disproportionately affected, and those industries employ more people of color. All across our region, food banks have become an increasingly critical source of food for families.
Hi, is this Stephanie?
Yeah, hey.
Okay, this is Marion Budinsky, and I'm handing the phone to Big Bill, who comes here with his son to pick up food once in a while, okay?
Mary Ann runs the Poverty Resistance Food Pantry in Casper, Wyoming. The phone is getting bounced around as people wait to receive food.
Hello?
Hi, Big Bill.
How are you?
On the good days, there's veggies, fruits, and even hamburger meat up for grabs. But William Sells, or Big Bill, as they call him, says other days aren't so lucky.
Sometimes you get the onions. And I guarantee you, I've made onion soup many a times for dinner. And my little boy loves it because he'll grab my hand and say, I'm just thankful you're here.
In Nevada, Jocelyn Landtrip says they've seen hundreds of new faces of recently unemployed families at the Northern Nevada Food Bank. But Landtrip says the new faces added to an already long list of people in need.
Our low-income neighbors had not recovered from the recession. We had a significant issue with people who were working full-time jobs and still couldn't pay their bills. What we saw was higher rents, higher expenses, incomes not really matching those expenses in our area.
What the pandemic is doing well, sadly, is exposing communities who have always needed help. That includes communities that lack easy access to healthy foods, like the Walker River Paiute tribe in Nevada. Amber Torres is the tribal chairman. The reservation is a food desert, she explains. The nearest grocery store is nearly 30 miles away. The nearest Costco is 2 hours away in Reno.
Access is a huge barrier for us here on the reservation.
When the pandemic first hit, the state supplied food boxes to those in need on the reservation, but eventually that giveaway stopped. So the tribe turned to the local tribal council and the Nevada Food Bank
to get our own food pantry established here on the reservation, because we definitely know the pandemic isn't going away.
But that's not all. The reservation was able to tap into federal funds to invest in another sustainable project.
We put some of our CARES funding into a food sovereignty program, you know, where we planted in the hoop houses where we would be able to vegetate throughout the year.
Hoop houses are outdoor gardens. It's one new source of fresh fruits and vegetables on the reservation, growing everything from apples to cucumbers and peppers. Torres said she immediately saw the impact of both the new food pantry and the local garden.
We saw that there was a true need across the board. You know, even with these families that have two income homes, you know, it was still something that was supplemental and really helped their family as well, you know, especially because, you know, you could go shopping for a small time frame that runs out during the week, you know, and then I don't want to put it like this, but you're SOL.
The reservation is also stepping up its game by working with other community groups like the local Boys and Girls Club. They're helping them identify families with children so that the kids can get snacks when the families are visiting the reservation's new food pantry. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Stephanie Serrano.
Coming up, a story on fairy rings and a look at Wyoming Public Media's new podcast called The Carbon Valley. This is Open Spaces.
In part one of the new limited series, Carbon Valley, Wyoming searches for a way to stop the decline of coal. Under Governor Matt Mead, the answer became carbon capture, a technology that aims to store or use emissions.
If you can solve that, you not only help the coal industry, but you may be able to create industries out of that in our own backyard where coal is so plentiful.
To do that, Mead had to do something big. Listen for part one of Carbon Valley on March 16th. Find it under the podcast tab at wyomingpublicmedia.org. or wherever you download your podcasts.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Fairy rings are all around Wyoming. You may have seen them without noticing. They look like rings of extra green grass or mushrooms. Wyoming Public Radio's Ashley Piconi explains how fairy rings got their name and what really creates them.
Dancing looked very different in the past. Anthropology professor at the University of British Columbia, Sabina Magliocco, says everybody used to dance in circles.
At one time, circle dancing was actually the most prevalent form of folk dance all over Europe. People would dance in a circle, usually at festivals and celebrations.
She says people would dance outside of churches or their homes, but fairies were different.
Fairies would dance in these places out in the countryside, and they would leave this evidence that they had been there.
This evidence? Fairy rings, or perfect circles of green grass and mushrooms. Magliocco says fairies were a way for people to explain the unexplainable rings they were seeing.
The word weird actually is tied to the old Anglo-Saxon word that means fate or destiny. So if something was weird in the old days, it was somehow connected with fate or destiny or mystery or the unknown. And fairy rings were definitely weird to our ancestors.
She says people were often afraid of fairies. It was commonly believed that fairies would punish people for breaking certain social norms. Intruding inside a fairy ring was one of them.
Stepping inside the fairy ring, because that was fairy space, because that had been marked as fairy space, could get you into trouble.
But University of Wyoming botany professor Steve Miller says it's probably okay to step inside of one of the rings. He says it's now understood that fairy rings are created by fungus as it grows through grass.
The ring itself is a zone where they have killed the grass and then they've kind of fertilized the next layer of grass out. So the grass that forms the fairy ring is much greener than the other grass around it.
Miller says the circles can continue to grow as long as they have a flat and moist area.
Because it takes all of the nutrients in a certain zone around the growth of the fungus, it can only grow outward. In an area that's very, very large, they can continue to grow for a very, very long period of time.
He first noticed the fairy rings in Wyoming from the air. And as a botanist, he was fascinated.
I used to be a pilot and I had a small airplane. So I flew all over the Laramie Basin because I love to look at the different physiographic features, the grass and the lakes and the rivers and everything. And I was just astounded by how many fairy rings that were out there.
Miller says it's not hard to find fairy rings on your own.
If you go to Google Earth and you look at the westernmost runway at the Laramie Regional Airport, it looks like big Olympic rings off of the end of the runway, and those are fairy rings. And once you see those, then you can start looking all over.
Using Google Earth and historical images, Miller and his research team measured the age and size of fairy rings in the Laramie Basin. He says the largest circles are 100 meters across. They grow about 4 centimeters per year. So that means they've been around for a long time.
We've traced the fairy rings over the years and created an average growth rate. And from that, we can back calculate how old they are. And some of the fairy rings are easily 2,000 years old.
Miller says that many species of fungi form fairy rings. And in some cases, they come in contact with each other and create complicated structures.
So you end up with not necessarily full rings, but all kinds of arcs and half moons and things like that.
Of course, not everybody loves fairy rings. They can be pesky when they show up on golf courses or yards because they're notoriously hard to get rid of. But anthropologist Magliocco says that's part of the magic.
I think that human beings must have been fascinated by these formations, right? I mean, they are perfectly round. And they often occur seasonally. They often occur in the same areas again and again.
Miller says fairy rings are a natural part of life. Instead of getting rid of them, he says we should enjoy them and the stories they inspire. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Ashley Piconi.
Coming up this month, Wyoming Public Media will be releasing Carbon Valley. It's a bi-monthly limited series following the race to develop an unlikely climate solution. Wyoming Public Radio's Nina Rao sat down with energy reporter Cooper McKim, who developed the series, and they talk about how Carbon Valley came about and what drove the decision to create it.
So carbon capture has always been a big topic in Wyoming, with really high expectations to sort of be the state's response to a decline in coal production. But when I came to Wyoming, my perception of this technology, which it can be a million things I learned, but at the time, my perception of it was really simple, that it was something celebrated by environmentalists and the left as a way to mitigate climate change. So it sort of seemed ironic to me that on one hand, there are folks saying, hey, this is going to be amazing to limit climate change. We need it for 2050 climate goals. There's all these international reports that say so. And on the other hand, Wyoming lifting it up and saying, this is what we need to save coal. So when I learned about this competition in the Carbon X Prize, it seemed like a perfect opportunity to cut past the rhetoric and just follow this story on the ground. And the podcast itself follows this competition, which is still underway today, to just really get me on the ground as a reporter and connect with folks rather than just hearing about this in speeches. So all of those elements led to me wanting to do this long-term project.
Right. So tell us more on what this podcast is about.
So as I mentioned, the Carbon X Prize is the main topic that it follows. So it uses that as a lens to cover the larger issue of carbon capture. So there's this sort of tension between carbon capture being a solution for coal country while also being this solution held up for climate change. So it explores that issue, gets into what carbon capture really is, and also follows along with the challenges for the kind of companies that Wyoming wants to attract. So CCUS, as it's called, carbon capture, utilization, and storage, it's not just one thing. It's not just a big vacuum that sucks carbon dioxide out of the air. Perhaps that would be a little bit better for the climate than carbon capture utilization, which can be beneficial in reducing emissions, but isn't necessarily that. So the podcast digs into all of these tensions and contradictions while following one specific startup competing in this competition over the course of 2 years and checking in with them, seeing what the challenges are. For example, I learned that capital, getting funding, is really one of the biggest challenges to making this technology work, but also that it's really, really hard to get this technology off the ground, which is telling given that's what Wyoming has really hitched its wagon to as its economic future, at least for reversing the production curve for coal.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think it's so timely and important for this podcast to be released this year, 2021?
So pretty much since 2018, and even before that, since Wyoming began talking about carbon capture, there has been this massive shift in progress in recent years. The number of large-scale facilities has multiplied by four since 2010. The capacity for carbon capture has increased. The cost of it has gone down. You know, Elon Musk announced this year an $100 million competition for carbon capture. So it seems like this collaborative bipartisan thing, even though there are so many who say that this is a waste of resources. And as these concerns become bigger for coal and for the climate, I think this is sort of a perfect middle ground to discuss a potential climate solution.
So you already got me hooked, but
good.
If you had to explain for folks like me who are a beginner or not familiar with issues regarding energy and climate and why they should give Carbon Valley a listen, what would you say?
I think the first thing is just that it's an enjoyable story first. I think there are really great characters. There's a natural tension. The main character is the former CEO of a skateboard company. It's not the regular energy folks you hear from. And at the same time, if folks listen to Radiolab, you're not necessarily going in thinking you're interested in DNA or whatever the topic is, you know, or listening to a podcast about Dolly Parton. Sometimes it's an entry point to get interested in energy and the environment and climate. And the last thing is it's a story about Wyoming, but it's really a universal story just about a battle for the future. You know, if you've ever turned your lights on, you've probably consumed coal, even though it might not seem like it, given you're not going to the store and buying it. So I think this story really relates to all of us.
Will there be anything surprising, or is there anything surprising that will come from this podcast?
So one of my favorite things is that over the course of 2 years, it really has been a unique opportunity for these tensions to play out in real time. As radio reporters, we're used to seeing these stories kind of already wrapped up. You know, we sort of know what happens by the time we get to it. But with this, there is so much that actually unfolds and I'm responding to it in real time. You know, I'll just tease, I'm scared at one point that my main character is gonna drop out of the competition. The competition also doesn't exactly go as planned. And so throughout the series, there's a lot of things that just happen very organically that I think are informative about the story of carbon capture that this is following.
Oh my God, I'm very curious now.
Good.
Cooper McKim, Wyoming Public Radio's energy reporter and now creator of Carbon Valley. Thanks for talking to me, Cooper.
Thanks, Nana.
Carbon Valley will premiere on March 16th, and you can find it on carbonvalleypodcast.org.
I hope you enjoyed this edition of Open Spaces. You can hear a replay of the entire program or find individual segments on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Segments will also be available on social media. And never miss an episode by signing up for our Open Spaces podcast. Please support this award-winning program with your pledge today. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.